Hello, hello, hello. This is Cortina Jackson, and I am on What's on Cortina Jackson's Mind. You guys, I am so excited to have with me this evening such an astounding and brilliant man, Mr. Melvin Lars. How are you, sir?
Ms. Cortina, I am great, and the check is in the mail for deeming me being brilliant. I will mail that check as soon as we get off of this broadcast.
You know, there will be no need, because when people hear your accomplishments, which are just amazing, you know, with you going through so much, everyone will know that you are brilliant, just a brilliant man. And, you know, you're quite welcome. Just to let the guests know, I met Mr. Lars a couple of years ago at the National Black Book Festival.
Just Lars, not just Lars. That's I go by Lars. That's fine.
Lars, okay, yeah. Easy. It was actually my very first book signing, and it was my first book, first signing, never done anything publicly before. And I won a contest that year for a short story contest.
Yes, you did.
And was very excited, very nervous, and you so warmly congratulated me. Yeah. And, you know, we traded information and we vowed to keep in touch.
Yes.
And I'm just so excited because you were a man of your word more than you were a man of your word, and that you kept in touch with me. Yes. And not only that, you know, you shared my information, you shared books, you shared my post on Facebook, and really did your very best to put me in a good light for people to see, you know, someone who is so new and so unknown. And it meant the world to me. And you're my hugest supporter. And it was just a no-brainer. To have you, I consider it quite an honor just to have you here with me.
Well, thank you very much. The honor is mine. And as I said to you before we start the show, you know, people do not see the stars that are present around us, and you are certainly a star.
Oh, thank
you. And I'm so happy that I had the opportunity to meet you and to stay in contact with you, because I love watching stars. And you are certainly a star. So, and you are a very, very bright star. So it was very easy for me to share your information and to maintain contact. So I just want your audience to know that you are, you know, and street lingo, you the stuff.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. I'm in such great company. So I'm thankful. And I want people to know about you. So we're going to jump right into this, because this, as I said to you before, this is all about you today. We know what's on Cortina Jackson's mind most of the time, but I definitely want to know what's on yours, because you have such an extensive, you know, things that you've been through, things that you've done. So as we jump into this, you have defied the impossible. From your humble beginnings, growing up, jump into this and tell us where you're from, who are you, how'd you get here, what was life like, you know, that started this whole thing?
Well, actually, Cortina, and thank you for that, I am from a place called Bossier City, Louisiana. Now, most people are aware of New Orleans. Many of them are aware of Shreveport.
Mm-hmm.
And Bossier City are twin cities. And Bossier is the smaller of the two, which is where I was reared.
Yes.
So that's, you know, I just tell people very honestly, I've lived in Shreveport, but I hail from Bossier City. And my life started out, like a lot of people, just as a challenge from a young boy all the way through now to be an old man. And there were many challenges in between. And you know, I'm very humble and very grateful to God that he saw fit to allow me to continue to move throughout this process.
Yes, yes. Wow, I know that area very well. I'm in the Dallas area, so that's a straight shot. That's the first place we run into when we get into Louisiana.
Yes.
Wow, okay, so growing up, what was home life for you? Because I know that you had some challenges,
yes.
Even at the young age of 8.
Yes.
So tell me about this. Tell me growing up in your home, what it was like, even with your mother, because we're going to find out she is a big influence in your life. And you know, a lot of the things that you've been through kind of shape the way that, that things happen for you later in life. So tell us a little bit about your mom, your upbringing, and then, you know, dive into that.
Well, you know, Cortina, I'd like to share with you and the audience is that my beginning started out, unfortunately, very, very, very frustrating. Mm. I was a child that did not enjoy Christmas. I was brought up in a house that was fraught with domestic violence, you know, having to watch my mom get beat up and all of that kind of thing and feeling very helpless as not being able to help her. Yeah. As a young kid, I remember to this day, my stepfather was fighting on my mother. And I told him, if you're so bad, fight me. Now, I'm a little boy. I wasn't even school age. And I could hear my grandmother now when my stepfather turned around and said something. And she said, you better not hit that boy. I'll blow your brains out.
Wow. So
I don't remember I don't remember if he turned to come toward me or what. I do remember my grandmother saying that to him, but he never put his hands on me at that point. So unfortunately, my mother would leave and come back and leave and come back and leave and come back and all that kind of thing. And it was very frustrating to me. And the reason I say I never enjoyed Christmas, because with my stepfather, unfortunately, like men may have, quote, other women on the side, et cetera, then she would catch the brunt of that, I guess, because he wanted to go and be with his other women on holidays. So he'd always find a reason to jump on her and beat her up around Christmas time and that kind of thing.
Wow.
So Christmas was never, I never enjoyed Christmas actually until I became an adult. So as a child, we dealt with that foolishness. And of course, as in black families, you know, we went to church a lot. And my great grandmother, Mary Ridges, she would always, you know, it would take us and put us on the mourner's bench and that kind of thing. We'd have to pray three times a day. And so finally, after one of those trips, I was like 8 years old, as you mentioned, I came home and my stepfather had beat my mother up again. So the next day, when my great grandmother was talking to me about going to revival, come on now, you know, you got to be up 6 o'clock, et cetera, I'm sitting on the bench at church. And as an 8 year old, I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, you know, where is God and all? God must have skipped my house. Mm. And as an 8 year old, this is what I'm thinking, because I'm going home to my mother having a swollen face, busted lips, and all this kind of craziness. And I'm saying, you have me here praying to God and talking about how good God is.
Right.
And beating the daylights out of my mother. You know, so and the parallel to that was, I've heard a lot of children talk about mean step parents. Mm. And I say parallel, but the irony was that I have to give credit where credit is due. He was never really mean to me and my sister or tried to hurt us or anything of that nature. But if you're hurting my mother, you're hurting me.
Right.
So a lot of the stories I would hear other kids talk about how their stepfathers would be mean to them and treat them badly, I have to give him credit. He really didn't do that to us, but he was hurting our mother. So that made things, of course, very ugly. And by the time I was 13, Cortina, I just had enough. And I challenged him at that point. And I have to say to you and your audience is that at the time when my mother would not let me take him out, because I wanted to take him out, Cortina.
Yes.
I did. I told him, if you hit her again, it's going to be your last time hitting anybody. And my mother turns around like parents do. That boy, shut up. Stay in children's place, blah, blah. So, you know, but growing up in the South, you know, you obey your parents.
Right.
But I had it. I'd made up my mind. And so I just kept standing there. And I was trying to get to him, but my mom was standing between us. And obviously, I don't want to cause her any pain.
Yeah.
But what made me enraged, Cortina, was here's this man who pretends that he's this tough guy beating up my mother, but you afraid of a 13-year-old. You hiding behind my mom talking about you ain't that strong. See, I was always a big kid, Cortina.
Wow.
I was always a big kid. I was always, you know, I matured early. I was always, I just matured early for my age. And then I'm like 5'10" at 13 years old, 200 plus pounds, and I was an athlete, and I was blessed to be a pretty good one, even at an early age.
Wow.
So he wanted to protect himself, and at the time, I was really angry with my mother because I felt like she was protecting him.
Right.
But as I got older, I realized that she was protecting me from going to jail or something like that. But, you know, it took me a while to, and I won't lie to you, it took me a while to receive that.
Right.
I've been angry with her for quite some time. But what it did do, Cortina, is it caused her, she finally left for good.
Oh.
That she had left and returned. I mean, listen, I can't count the number of times she returned.
Yes.
So finally, I guess it finally sunk into her that this was not going to work any longer.
Mm.
So we moved and stayed with my grandmother for a short time. Then, you know, in the South, they have what's called these shotgun houses.
Oh, yes.
You can stand on the front porch and see out the back.
All the way through it, yes.
So we moved in one of these shotgun houses and actually stayed in one until I was graduating from high school. Well, I was a junior, but, you know, so make a long story short, you know, we did what we had to do. I had to be, quote, and we'll talk about my book, I guess, later, but I had to be the man and the son.
Right.
And I always worked at an early age anyway, so I had to help take care of my younger siblings. You know, a lot of times people give you these stories. I didn't have to drop out of school or anything of that nature, but I was fortunate enough. I was living in the city, so I could go to work and then go to school and things of that nature. So it was certainly a challenge, and it grew me. And what was even tougher, being blessed to have be a football star, it was tougher, but it was. It gave me an outlet.
Right.
I could go out and beat people up without having to go to jail. So
wow.
football kind of gave me a release. But also, in that, I never could understand, and I can't understand to this day, how can you call yourself a man and you punching around and slapping around a woman? How can you say you love somebody and you punching them around and slapping them around and causing them all kind of this pain?
Yeah.
Like, you know, that to me is an idiot. You know, I don't to this day, and I tell my son the same thing, and other young men that I mentor. I said, help me understand who in their right mind want to see their woman, their wife, face swollen, lips busted, she's crying, she's upset, you've damaged her. I said, what sane person?
Exactly.
So to make a long story short, I have been fighting that battle for a long time. It scars you and it stays in your head. And I have to tell this story and we can move on. Approximately, oh heck, I was living in Houston at the time and I was working in the oil field during the summers. I'm driving from San Antonio, Texas. Now, mind you, I'm when I say grown, I'm full grown.
Right.
My stepfather had passed away.
Oh.
And it just, this rage came over me while I'm driving down Interstate 10 in Houston. I said, I need to go, I don't want to curse on your show, but I said, I need to go dig that SOB up and kick his.
Yes.
Yeah. And I said,
yes.
So it's, people don't understand that things like that scar you for life.
And
you really have to work hard to work through it. You really have to be prayed up, and sometimes that wheel turned in your head and you play those kinds of things back. So,
yes.
You know, just as a young man, just dealing with that craziness, you know, was crazy enough. So, but going to school was very rewarding. I always believed in getting my lesson and doing the things that I'm supposed to do. Getting a football scholarship was really the highlight of my life. I knew that I wanted to go to college. I didn't exactly know how I was going to get there.
Right.
I'm the first in my family, in my immediate family, to go to college. And, you know, no one in my household had gone to college. I didn't know of my great-grandmother could not even read her name. My grandmother could read, my mom could read, et cetera.
Yes.
And my mother had gone as far as the 11th grade. She didn't graduate from high school. So no one had gone to college. My granddad, I think, had stopped school in the third grade. So even the men that I were around, even though they all worked and had jobs, my uncles, et cetera, none of them had advanced past high school.
Wow.
So make a long story short, I first went to Mississippi Valley State University in Mississippi, of all places. And I was there for a year and a quarter, and things worked out really well for me. My mother got really sick. My friend and I transferred closer to home. And I tell people very unashamedly is that I was one of those African-American kids. I had no business at a white college. None. Because
Oh, wow.
I wasn't having it. So it was a very bumpy road at Louisiana Tech, where I graduated from in 1975. I'll tell you how old I am. I graduated in 1975. I was, wow. At the time I was 21, and I graduated in 1975, and I was fortunate enough to be a free agent with the Houston Oilers. I got released wow. from the Houston Oilers, and that's how I started coaching in Dickinson, Texas.
Huh.
I met some really, really great people there in Dickinson. As a matter of fact, a young man named Donnie Little was the first African-American quarterback to ever play quarterback at the University of Texas.
And wow.
And I need to give you his name as well. We'll talk about it later. His
oh,
name,
yes, for sure.
He's certainly a historian. And he led the University of Texas to number one in the country and this kind of thing. And Donnie and I remained close friends to this day. So I was afforded a lot of opportunity through education. And that's why, as we're talking about this, I'll just share briefly, is I like young men to understand and young women to understand that when people keep pushing education, sadly, we don't do a very good job of explaining why.
Right.
Education. It's about options. You know, some people, and you know this as well as I, some people think that it makes you better. It's nothing, I don't have nothing to do with you being better than anybody.
Exactly.
About options.
Yes.
So, you know, the Lord blessed me to be able to do that. Got my master's at Texas Southern University.
Nice.
And superintendent certification in Youngstown. Well, I finished it up at Youngstown, Ohio. Started out in Eastern Michigan. So, and it has afforded me a lot of opportunities. It has afforded me to meet a lot of people that I would not have ordinarily met. And it has put me in arenas that I would not ordinarily have been in. So, you know, just the entire process coming from a home, with a mom who didn't have a high school diploma, growing up through domestic violence, being angry with my father, to be very honest, I'll be honest with you, but, you know, and that, I talk some, about some of that in my book very briefly, is that in my situation, I have to put that out there. In my situation, I was angry with my father, but it wasn't his fault. And what I mean by it wasn't his fault, my mother decided she wanted this other guy who happens to be the guy that beat her and mistreated her.
Yes.
As opposed to my father. Now, I didn't find this out until I'm like 15 years old. So finally, I confronted my dad. I did. And I said, well, hey, man, you know, what's the deal? You
wow.
know, I haven't seen you. You don't come around. You don't help take care of me. But I'm just, you know, talking. So he said, well, what did your mama tell you?
Wow.
So he starts to tell his side of the story.
So important to get both yes. sides.
So to tell his side of the story, she chose my stepdad. You know, so and people have a right to choose who they want to choose.
Yeah.
But a lot of times we hear all these stories about. Of course, I let him know at 15 that was no reason to abandon me.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And I think of course he wasn't pleased that I said those things, but I was very serious and you know, so and I'm grateful that he and I, before he went to sleep, we actually established a great relationship from the time he unfortunately he passed away. May 9th, 2000.
Oh, wow.
But we were actually able to forge a great relationship from that point on mm-hmm. until the year 2000. But, you know, I just kind of wanted to share that with you a little bit because many times people don't understand that, yes, we all have stories.
Yes.
Sometimes they are similar. Sometimes they are vastly different. So
right.
the aspect of education, as your listeners are tuned in with us, is that I tell people all of the time, education is extremely important because it affords you opportunity.
Yes.
Yes.
Now, you, and as we will hear, you know, you got your master's degree and with a family who really didn't push much for education.
Yes.
What motivated you to just keep going, you know, with, because at any time you could have said, okay, I'll stop at the associate's degree.
Yeah.
I'm still doing good. I'm still doing, but you just kept going and going.
Yes.
And, what was your push, you know, for those who think, you know, I don't know. I don't want to keep going through this.
Well, you know, Cortina, and you're the first person to ask me this. But as I think about it, it may have been fear. I loved my family, but uh-huh. I didn't want to be them. And what I mean by I didn't want to be them, because I saw them so limited.
Yes.
You know, I love them dearly to this very day, and we have a great relationship, I'm happy to say. But I didn't want to always be limited to what I could do. I always took on challenges. in my life. As I said, I started working as a very true story. As you asked, what kept me going at 13 years old, when I, after my mother left my stepdad, I pretended to be 16 because I was always big, and that's only you couldn't get a job at that time unless you were at least 16. Mm. So I started working at a Church's Fried Chicken. 13 years old, they thought I was 16.
Wow.
I did not want my life to end up, be very honest with you, and not to put anybody down, because right. all work is honorable. But I did. I saw myself doing something more challenging and other than. And I saw myself putting forth my mind as opposed to always laboring physically.
Right.
So that just kind of kept me going. And I did not, Cortina, want to be labeled that dumb jock. To this day, I detest that. I try to get young people to understand very simply.
Yes.
Is that I say when somebody call you a student athlete, they're really insulting you. And they go, oh, coach, what do you mean? I said, because it's an oxymoron. Mm. Everybody understands that when you go to school, you're a student.
Right.
So someone say student athlete as if they are complimenting you, you
yes.
have to be careful about that. So
right.
after I would talk to young men about that and young women, I started researching the word student athlete. And it was back, Cortina, my intuition was right on point. And if people look it up, the word student athlete got coined, an athlete, I can't think of the university, and he was a quote, less melanated gentleman, white, unquote.
Uh-huh.
And he got injured. The mom wanted the university to pay for his injuries, for his doctor's bills. They refused. The lawyer did some hocus pocus and put some little loopholes in there. And so their verdict was, because he's a student athlete, then the university is not obligated to pay the medical bills. It had absolutely nothing to do with his academic ability. I said, I knew it. I knew there had to be a glitch.
Wow.
To this very day, May 16, 2019, 99.9% of the population thinks that it's a compliment to be called a student athlete.
Student athlete.
Yes.
Wow.
And you have the NCAA jumped all over it and talking about they giving these awards and all this. So tell people how that term actually really got started. And then that's what I'm saying. So that's actually how that term got started. At the time, I did not know that. But I did understand this, that being an African-American young man and being a student and hearing all the stuff about, well, the teacher just gave them grades and this, that, and the other. It's like, no, I can read. I could read before I went to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother didn't play that. You know, she wasn't impressed. And that's, I love my mother very dearly. She wasn't impressed that I had a little talent playing sports. You know, and those old school moms.
Oh, yeah.
Take your butt to school, sit down, shut your mouth, get your lesson. And see, a lot of times people say, well, if you just go in there and be quiet. See, my mama didn't play that, go in there and be quiet. No, you're going to get your lesson.
Exactly.
You know? And I would hear people tell kids, well, you just go in there and be quiet. They're going to pass you. Bernice didn't play that. Go in there and get your lesson. So to completely answer your question, it was part fear, part not wanting to limit my opportunity, part, I guess, that ego, that male ego, that athletic drive, whatever. You know, even when I became a Golden Gloves boxing champion at 17, I've always loved football, but a friend of mine was boxing, and he invited me over. And plus, I was I decided to box a little bit because I used to fight all the time. Did I tell you that?
No.
Kids would tease me. Kids would tease me. Oh, man, you know the mama stuff. Your mama had a black eye. Your mom had a lip busted. So, listen, I'm not proud of that fact, Cortina. I used to fight all the time.
Oh.
And my mother never knew that I was fighting until my brother told her many years later. She never knew that I was fighting. And I was good at it. You know, I was good at it.
Oh, I bet.
One of my coaches, I never got in trouble in school. I always got my work. They couldn't figure out why I was fighting all the time.
Mm.
And I was fighting because the kids would tease me about my mother being beat up. So
wow.
They talked me into going to the gym. So I went to the gym, and I became a Golden Gloves boxing champion. And I had an opportunity to come to your hometown. to come to Dallas, Texas for the Olympic trials or go to college and play football. That was no decision for me.
Wow.
I went to college and play football.
Wow. Wow.
So that's, yes. And thank God things worked well for me at college. And as I said, I was afraid to go through all the day, released me. And I was coaching in Dickinson, Texas. And I was playing at that time, Cartina, you had real semi-professional football. You know, it wasn't just a bunch of guys getting together, calling themselves semi-pro. So we were affiliated with Houston Oilers. We were the Houston Titans, as a matter of fact. When the Oilers moved to Tennessee, the Tennessee Titans are now the Tennessee Titans.
I remember that, Trace.
They took our name.
Yeah.
That name in Tennessee when they moved to Tennessee. So make a long story short, I'd been out of college about 5 years, and I had an opportunity to go to the Oakland Raiders.
So, oh, wow.
Yes, then I got released from the Oakland Raiders. Then I took a job with the infamous, I think I was telling you once on maybe something that I was writing to you, Dr. George McKenna. Now, he's definitely one to interview. We'll talk about that too, Dr. George McKenna. Now, most people have heard of Joe Clark and Lean On Me.
Oh, yes.
But there's a George McKenna story that's played by Denzel Washington, my boss and my friend.
Yes.
So when I got cut from the Raiders, I needed a job. So I'm at L.A. In L.A., I went over to the school board office because I'd already been teaching and coaching for 5 years. And then let me tell you how God works. Out of all of these stacks of applications, you can't make this stuff up. The human resource guy comes out and picks up these stacks of applications. And normally, you know, they're going to send a secretary and they're going to bring them back. But fast forward. He's reading one, and then he said, And I'm sitting there, still sitting waiting on my cousin to pick me up because I don't know my way around L.A. He said, this looks like a guy that George may be interested in talking to. So I don't know if he's talking about me. So he says to the receptionist, he said, see if you can get this gentleman on a job. On the phone. And so she said, okay. And then so she started dialing, and she said, I can't get a call. She said, but I think he's still sitting out there. So I don't know they're talking about me, Cartina. So then he says, Mr. Lars? Then so I stood up and walked up to he said, I have a principal coming up that's looking for some really strong people. They were reading the piece that they ask, you know, your philosophy of education and all of that.
Right.
So I didn't know at the time, but that's what he was reading. So I said, so he asked me, did I know Dr. George McKenna? I said, no, sir, I just got to L.A. I just got released from the Raiders. He said, yeah, I see this on your resume. He said, but you're probably the kind of guy that he needs this. And plus, I'm looking here at your education thoughts, et cetera. He said, would you mind meeting with George? I said, of course, I need to work. So he said, he'll be here in a couple of hours. And at the time, I was dressed very casually. Mm. And I said, well, sir, I'm not dressed for an interview. He said, don't worry about that. And then the rest is history. Dr. McKenna came in. They interviewed me. He hired me on the spot. I went to his school. I became his head football coach. And I worked at his, Yes. And the rest is history.
Wow.
So, as it turns, unfortunately, when I left to move back, when I left to come back to Houston, because my wife refused to come to California.
Oh.
My ex-wife refused to come to California. So I went back to Houston. And as it would have it, because Washington was an East Side High. And by that time, everything had gotten cleaned up and straightened up. They'd come in and make the George McKenna story. So I don't get a chance to get to have a part in the movie.
Oh, you're kidding.
I'm very serious. But when you talk to Dr. McKenna, I'm telling you, he and I talk. We still have a great relationship. He was not happy that I left. When I went in and talked with him, I said, you know, I'm going back home, et cetera, et cetera. His family problems, et cetera, et cetera. And but you know, Cortina, that was a most rewarding experience.
Oh, gosh.
Actually being at the feet of the guru and really seeing someone that was really serious about educating children. It wasn't about the publicity. It wasn't about anybody patting him on the back.
Right.
He was really serious about that. And that's what was my thought then, as I think now. So as God would bless me, Cortina, I have been blessed, not Melvin Lars, but God has blessed me to have had assistant principals and teachers and students that want to turn their schools around. I've done it in Youngstown, Ohio. I've done it in Cleveland. I've done it in my hometown of Shreveport. And I've done it in Michigan.
Oh.
And so I'm serious. I was telling one of my friends, I said, heck, I'm waiting on my movie. I said,
where's my movie? Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh my God. So, now tell me this.
Yes.
You talked about a lot of ups and downs.
Yes.
Being cut from different teams. Like you said, you're a big guy. Yes. And you would think, oh, he's definitely got a spot.
Yes.
So as you're getting cut from these teams and different things aren't working out, did you experience any type of self-esteem or depression? Or did you just always think, okay, I was cut from that, I'm gonna move on. Were you able to move on quickly, or did you internalize some things?
I definitely internalized some of self-doubt. I thought, I'm going, wait a minute, you know, I'm very serious about this. I will have these talks with myself. I'm not understanding. You know, I said, wow, I'm whipping all the guys you're putting in front of me. But see, even today, as I answer the question, I have to share with you this way. In sports, there's so much politics. Mm. Then there's a certain height and all of that kind of thing. I've been 5'10" since I was 12. I never grew any taller.
Wow.
In a position that required you to be 6'3", 6'4", et cetera. But because I was such a physical player, and then they would give me opportunities to come in, but I was being used, and I tell kids all the time, they laugh so heartily. I said, man, I was being used as a practice dummy. And I tell them that because, and the way I break that down and answer your question, I said, if you look at the boxing world, they bring in sparring partners. They bring in certain sparring partners that they feel can challenge their guy and get him prepared to beat these other guys.
Right.
A lot of times is no different. However, when you are that, quote, sparring partner in football, and then you are beating all of these guys that they are paying all of this money and stuff like that, it does cause a lot of consternation. Now, there are some guys that I know that would say, well, hey, man, you know, I knew I was good enough, so that was on them. Well, no, it's kind of like this, Cartina. I have a saying that if you are a genius,
uh-huh,
and you are the only one that know you're a genius, what good does that do?
Exactly.
So I applied that same principle in football, was that, yeah, I know I'm good, but, you know, in order to be, quote, verified, certified, etc., then you have to stick with one of these teams and be a contributor. So yes, depressed, no, but question myself, yes. Sometimes wondering, and I'll be very honest, wondering if I was as good as I thought I was, yes. Wondering if I was as good as the coaches were saying I was, yes. Mm-hmm. But you know, it'd always be, you know, Lars, you do a great job, but you know, we need someone that's 2 or 3 inches taller. And, you know, I'd be saying, well, you knew that when you brought me in.
Right, right.
Yeah. So yes. That was a lot of consternation with me. Anger, frustration.
Yes.
Embarrassment, you know, all of the above.
Right.
Yes, all of the above.
Did you have anyone in your ear that ever said, hey, why don't you just give up? Why don't you just come back home or go over here, yeah, just sit down, just,
Yes, most certainly. And I'm going to be nice here.
Okay.
That's one reason I have the X1.
Yes.
Didn't believe in me.
Wow.
Didn't believe in me. And that sometimes can be very crushing.
Yes.
People do not admit that honestly, but sometimes it can be very crushing. And, you know, so you are sadly, many times you are surrounded by people that are friends and family that have these hidden jealousies. They really don't want to see you make it anyway.
Right.
They say nice things because they're the things to say.
Right.
They don't want to see you make it anyway. And now what that's about, God only knows. So I saw some of that. You know, sometimes you can see this, you can hear the snide remarks, and you can kind of see the looks on their faces,
right,
you know, look of doubt. And I always say, Cartina, situations like that is that, and I'm very serious, is that just because you doubt yourself, then don't try to put me on your playground.
Exactly.
You want to doubt yourself? Go right ahead.
Yeah.
Who am I to stop you? But you're not going to stop me.
Wow.
Yes.
And that's why, you know, you mentor a lot of guys, a lot of young men. And it's so important because they get, and I guess any man does, a lot of times we think a man should just be totally tough and not have feelings. But
yes.
You're able to speak to that because
yes.
We have to understand that young men get very discouraged. They hurt.
Yes.
They cry. It hurts.
Yes. Yes.
Because you've been through such these extreme circumstances with abuse in the home and
yes.
discouragement and being cut, you're able to speak to that, to these young men who,
yes.
and let them know it's okay if you get red shirted or gray shirted or you don't make the cut. It's okay.
Yeah.
It happens. Yeah. Just wonderful. Tell us about, you know, your mentor.
Yes.
You've even been an abuse. You got your degree or certification from Harvard for
violence intervention and prevention. Dealing with violence.
Yes.
Because you know, Cortina, if I can address that quickly, it's that I've never, and I just have to admit this to you on camera, I never liked bullies. Because
I don't either. Oh.
My thing always was, why would you want to cause somebody else pain? So I always worked, and let me say again, I thank God that he gave me the ability to be a physical specimen. And
yes.
he did. I was a big kid. I was strong. I could fight. I could play football. I could do all those things. And he gave me a good heart. Not that I'm perfect.
Right.
A good heart. So I would be the guy to beat up the bully. I would.
Yes.
So when I went into the teaching profession and coaching profession, my focus was to get these young men especially to understand that we need to be advocates for other human beings.
Yes.
You know, we don't need to bring them more pain. I mean, they're in enough pain already. And
yes.
pain is real.
Ugh.
And people need to understand, Cortina, and I know you know this, sweetheart, pain is real.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if you're male or female. So I didn't want to cause people additional pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I started to work with these young men, quote, that were in gangs, unquote, that were just doing all these uncomfortable, crazy kind of things, et cetera. And that's really how my career went. However, when I wanted to do some consulting work and information like that, people want you to have some paper, you know? That doesn't matter. And I'm going to say this, Cortina.
Yes.
Some people are going to take this as bragging, but I'm going to say it. Doesn't matter that you have more experience and you know more than the people that call themselves teaching and certifying you.
Oh, yes.
You still have to go through it because that's what's required. Now,
exactly.
Harvard and Dr. Renee Prothro-Stith did an excellent, excellent job. So I'm not saying that about her.
Right.
But, and the reason I had to share that is because when I would go and do consulting work or when I would tell people that I do consulting in violence intervention, prevention, et cetera, first thing they want to know is, what are your credentials? Well, I tell them, my credentials is working with gang members. My credentials is working with mothers.
Yes.
My credentials is going to funeral homes with mothers having to identify their sons with tags on their toes. My credentials is going to the jails. My credentials is writing letters to the judges. My credentials is talking to the young men that are involved in the game. Cortina.
Exactly.
True story. Green Oaks High School. Some of the young men that I had been coaching decided they didn't want to play football anymore. At that time, gangs hit us really hard. They one evening, they came to the school, about six of them in a car, to shoot some other gang members. True story. Your show is the first time this is being told.
Wow.
To shoot some other gang members. So all of these other gentlemen that I work with, these so-called tough guys, they all, I can't say the word, I want to say hiding out back up in the building. One of my kids comes to, so I go out by myself. Then these kids could have gunned me down.
Oh, yes.
But, you know, I say, man, something's got to be done. I walk out, and the way God would have it, I recognized one of the leaders, I won't call his name, as one of my former football players. So I called his name. I said, man, what y'all doing? Coach, he was, I don't know what all he was saying.
Yeah.
I said, man, what are y'all doing? I said, man, come talk to me. Man, I ain't coming over there, blah, blah. I said, well, I'm going to come out there and talk to you. No, Coach, don't stay over there, Coach. No, we're going to do this. And so I said, no, man, you guys can't do that. So while I'm talking with this young man, some, and I don't want to call kids names, but this very unintelligent, one of the other little gang members, opposing gang members, we had a two-story building. He's up in one building with his hand out of the window flashing gang signs.
Wow. Right?
So now this really gets them riled up.
So
I'm out here trying to calm them down and talk to them. So, and I'll be very honest with you, I was running out of stuff to say to them. So finally I said, I almost called his name. I said, Melvin, I said, I know the code of the streets. I said, and I understand the code of the streets is that you guys protect territory.
Mm.
I said, right now you guys are on my territory. I said, will you at least respect me that much that you don't come on my territory? And I'm not going to come on you. He said, but Coach, you don't understand. I said, I do understand. Because
right.
First of all, you are about to go to jail forever for shooting in a school, shooting a
right.
school, and you own federal government property, and all of you guys are going to be in jail forever. I said, I don't want to see that happen to you guys. I said, what I need you to do is just calm down, put that gun down, and talk to me. So we talked. They went and got in the car. And then so one of them said, that's okay. We'll get them on the way home. And Cartina, to this day, as God is my witness, they may have gotten them later in years, but we were able to squash it.
Oh, wow.
And that was nothing but God.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't me. He just happened. And so when we talk about the training and with Harvard and the violence intervention prevention, my experiences had all that prepared me.
Yes.
But I had to get the paper. Had to get the sheepskin.
Wow.
Yes.
You know, that's wonderful. It's wonderful that you got involved because people just aren't getting involved anymore. I've seen a couple of videos where a man will step in between and it's needed because with so many people just trying to step away and just trying to mind their business.
Yes.
We're a world that's really in trouble.
Yes.
And so your involvement with young people and the things you've done and you've taken your own pain and have really helped. You never know. These young men probably later on grew up and remembered that. No matter what happened with them later, they'll always remember that. Always.
Martina, I get all the time. They search me out on Facebook.
That's good.
I my birthday was on the 11th, which was Saturday, and I really they had me in tears. You know, I got all these birthday wishes and that type of thing from young men that I thought would be long dead by now.
Right.
So and they thanked me for saving them and that kind of thing. And yes.
Oh, that's. Yes. That's
of course, amazing. That's not all of them. You can't save everybody.
Right.
But I've been very blessed. To have made a difference. And like I tell them, Cartina, they made a difference in my life too.
Yes.
They made me look at myself. You know,
right.
they made me understand things more in depthly. They made me understand that, people have different kinds of pains. Of course, I knew that.
Yes.
But dealing with them at such a young age, you know, with all the pain that they're going through and dealing with and things of that nature. So like I tell them, they made a major impact on, well, they all call me Coach Lars. So they all made a major impact on Coach Lars as well.
Awesome.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
I really want to hear about your books because later, and also we'll get the information for them, but tell me about your books. I'm very excited about them. This kind of will give us some more detail about your life as well.
Okay.
So yes, please, if you have them.
I do.
Let us know. Give us a synopsis of them.
Cartina, I first start with Dying on My Feet. And the reason I start with Dying on My Feet is because what we haven't talked about yet is most people do not know that I am a acute promyelocytic leukemia survivor.
Mm.
In 1990, I was given no chance to survive. It's a very rare form of leukemia. There is no treatment to this day for the type of leukemia that I had. They tried various experiments. I would go in and out of remission for a period of 2 years. So finally, they just figured, hey, there's nothing else we can do, so we may as well just send him home. And That was 28 years ago. That was 28 years ago. I am completely cancer-free.
Oh.
I have been cancer-free for 26 years. And that's what this book is about, dying on my feet. When you asked me earlier, and you didn't know this, but when you asked me earlier about what kept me going, that I don't know. I just wouldn't stop. So when I decided to write this book about, it's a book about strength, motivation, transformation, all of that. When I decided to write this book, the reason I titled it Dying on My Feet, because I was literally dying on my feet. A friend of mine is a physician, real quickly. And I'd been complaining about a rash in my chest. He had given me salve and stuff to put on it. But also what I wasn't telling him, I was having these deep night sweats. When I shave in the morning, I was almost like a hemophiliac. I don't have bumps on my face, but I would notice all these red spots on my towel. And so I look in my mirror, I don't see no bumps, but the blood was coming out of my pores. So I'd ride down the street at night, I would see red in headlights, blood was leaking into my eyes. Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. And my teeth still now, I used to have perfect teeth. I was one of those people didn't have to have braces, and you can see my teeth are still separated. I used to have perfect teeth. But make a long story short, I titled this book Dying on My Feet because I was literally dying, but I kept going. So when they released me from the Salmon Cancer Treatment Center in Dallas, Texas, and most people never heard of it. I had never heard of it either.
Right. You know,
Anderson and all these other places.
Uh-huh.
Right. But Salmon was for the rich people that we never hear of.
I see.
And because we had premium insurance, then I guess they figured, well, we may as well get some of his money. He's not going to be around long. So I never saw anybody in that Salmon camp. I think now they renamed it Baylor. I was the only person in there that looked like me. But, yes. But.
Oh, my.
When they sent me home, they gave me all these instructions about what to do, what not to do. I never stopped. I just kept right on going. And I said, hey, if I die, I'm going to die on my feet. So I have that book, Dying on My Feet. And that is why I titled the book that. And I still feel that way to this day. I tell people all the time, if I die, I'm going to die standing. And it had nothing to do with me being macho. It had nothing to do with any of that. It just had to do with, you know, hey, keep moving. I'm not going to sit down and die. Not going to happen. So that's how that book came about. And I wrote it for inspirational purposes, for people to have hope, for people to be motivated, for people to be inspired, for people to be transformed. You know, I wanted them to see a real person, a real person that actually survived. Because many times, you know, you see things on TV and people wonder if it's phony or not.
Right.
I want them to see a real person that people knew. And they all thought I was going to die. Say, oh, they all thought I was going to die. You know, they even, true story. Have you ever known or have you ever heard a story of any job voluntarily putting a person on disability retirement without them requesting it?
No.
Neither had I until it happened at Caddo Parish Schools.
Wow.
I never drew a dime because I didn't stop working. I kept coaching, I kept teaching, then I went into I was already doing part-time administration. Then I went into administration full-time, and I just kept right on going.
Wow.
So I never drew a dime of that disability money because I just kept, because see, the doctors had already told them that I was not going to make it. So they weren't expecting me to come back to work. So God still got me rolling, and that's dying on my feet. Now, I'm on the court.
I got to recover from this.
Yes.
Oh, okay, please, go on. That's...
I'm also a poet. This is my fourth poetry book that I've written.
Oh.
It is called, I named this book, Poet, Songs in the Key of Life. And the reason I did that is because, and I say, again, not being cocky, but most people, when they read my poetry, they say, man, you know, seems like we're sitting there talking to you. I said, that's what I want to be. So I have been deemed not only the conversationalist poet, but I also have been deemed the intellectual poet. And I'm very proud of those tags.
Yes.
So I like to make sense out of rhyme, and I like to talk to people about life because I wanted my poetry book to be inspiration as well. I didn't want just regular standard old poetry book.
Right.
Inspiration as well. So that is where this book came from.
Wow.
Mind muscle.
Mind muscle.
Last thing I want to say about that, you know, I told you earlier about being an athlete and how people like to think that we can't think, we can't articulate, we can do none of those things, right?
Right.
Not here. Bernie didn't play that. I went to school, I sat down, and I got my education.
Yes.
So that's another reason I decided to make this mind muscle. And my last book, of which I'm really proud, the one I just got off the press is Friday.
Ah.
It's Mothers and Their Smen.
Smen.
Now people say, what's a smen? I said, you have to understand, a smen is when you are the son, but you have to assume the role of a man, but still stay in your place as a son.
That's important.
Yes,
I want to hear about this because I have smen.
Okay.
I do. And you know, because a lot of times mothers put their sons in that place to be the man.
Yes.
Tell us.
And that's what this book talks about. It talks about mothers themselves and how they are perceived and how they are expected to raise these quintessential men, but they are always told, and see, that's the major oxymoron.
Yes.
Well, women can't raise no men. Well, why don't you step up, man?
Yeah.
Why is mom left with the responsibility of raising what she can't raise?
Yes. So
I bring that up in this book. I talk about that. I talk about domestic violence. I talk about sons that are survivors of domestic violence. You know, I talk about mothers' influence on their sons. We talk about how mothers, again, are expected to raise these quintessential men without the aid of men, but incessantly being ridiculed by society because the man doesn't turn out the way society thinks he should turn out.
Yes.
That's why I say that's the oxymoron. But we constantly say that mothers are supposed to raise these men and then turn right around and say she can't raise men.
Wow.
So I wanted to challenge my readers to really think about all of the things that we say to mothers, because whether men like it or not, Cartier and I do a workshop called Dad's in the House, but He's Not Home.
Ooh.
And I talk about that in this book as well, because see, people love to talk about single parent home. Heck, single parent homes are single parent when a man is in the house. Too many times. Should I say? I guess I'm being mean here. Or should I say when a male is in the house?
Yeah. You
know, and people confuse a lot of times, and that's why I say, you know, when I wrote that book, I wanted to highlight things that we do not talk about openly and honestly when it comes to mothers, when it comes to sons. I even have a chapter here called A mother's view, bird's eye view, and a son's bird's eye view of his mom once he becomes an adult, and how we as sons start to realize all of the pain, that the stuff that our mother had to sacrifice, things she went through, etc. Whereas a little boy, and as boys, we didn't grasp those things.
Right.
So I wanted to make a complimentary book to moms, but I wanted it to be a eye-opener for sons and for men.
Yes.
And we end it with 10 questions, 10 study questions, like for book clubs and that type thing. I ask them certain things about the book, you know, what did you learn, things, research information. But see, Cortina, when you look things up about mothering and sons, et cetera, you'll find a pamphlet or somebody that may have written a paper.
Right.
I wanted a comprehensive document that would cover those layers.
Wow.
So you could have a holistic piece of information to really give mothers something to work with, to give the son something to work with, to give men something to work with, because I do let them know in this book very, very clearly, partner, just because you're in the house, that doesn't indicate that you're home. Yes.
Wow.
Because I have seen it. I've seen it too many times, Cortina. You know, and I hear people, you know, kind of turn their lip up and talk people down. Well, you know, she ain't got no man in the house. Got nobody. You got a man in the house. And he ain't doing his part to raise his kids.
Exactly.
I challenge men all the time. And I tell them, to me, it's very simple. If my job raising boys is to talk to them about drugs, talk to them about alcohol, take them to the ball game, then my job is just partly done.
Yeah.
I need to talk to them about nurturing, about caring, about how to treat their wives, how to treat their girlfriends, about chivalry is not dead.
Right.
About
right.
how to care, and that kind of thing. So men have been given a pass that we haven't earned. Mm. And I like to challenge the brothers. You know, and for me, Cortina, they're all brothers, regardless of race, creed, or color.
Yeah.
I like to challenge the brothers, you know, because people talk a lot of trash about, you know, women this and women that, and what his mama is. Perfect example, my nephew, and I'm going to give him a plug, named Johnny Williams.
Mm.
His son now, I think Jonathan is 13 or 14, but he was complaining to me when Jonathan was still in diapers. Oh, Uncle Bill, his mama, he's sitting around, he didn't need his diaper chair. Hey, man, I did. I said, we call him Buddy. I said, you know I love you, right? I said, now, so if you, and they weren't together. They, I said, so if you really love your son, then go get him.
Yeah.
I said, if you guys can't make it, and you feel that she is not taking care of your son, then you take care of him. And he's had him ever since.
Wow.
And I'm so proud of him. Not because he removed him from his mother, because everybody wants to be with their mother. Not because of it, but unfortunately, he was in a situation that wasn't good.
Yes, yes.
So instead of my nephew standing on the outside ridiculing the mother, then your job anyway is to take care of your son.
Yes.
So he's been with him ever since.
Oh, that's
what I try to get men to understand, Cortina, is that by you ridiculing mom does not abdicate you of any responsibility of raising your children.
No.
Male or female. So you can ridicule mom all you want, and you shouldn't, but it's not going to abdicate you from raising your children.
That's right.
So that's what mothers and their men.
Oh, ridicule. I love it. Oh,
that's what it talks about.
I don't think that's been done. Not,
it hasn't.
Not to that extent.
There's nothing on the market like it. There's nothing on the market
finally,
like it.
Finally. Yeah. Because I think mothers, you know, of course, I went through domestic violence raising two sons. And yes. I think mothers feel a degree of guilt.
Yes.
And they tend to, you know, sometimes nurture their sons too much. Some don't know how to handle that.
Yes.
And I know that that's addressed in there. And
it is.
Yes,
please.
I have gone through that. I felt so guilty about what I put them through that I almost became. We're mothers are already, you know, mother bears. We take care of our babies, but it you know, almost like I don't know what to do with them after that.
Let me do this for you. I put a special note in here, and it says it's on page 8. It says special note to mothers. The topic is get rid of your guilt.
Wow.
It says most mothers do the best that they know how when rearing their children. Do not allow a lack of knowledge, understanding, and support during the process of rearing your children to be an albatross. Release your mind and cease holding it hostage. Mental crippling will not heal itself. When one ceases to exercise her muscles, they begin to atrophy, resulting in loss of strength. Mothers give up this strength by badgering themselves. This produces self-induced anxiety, doubt, frustration, humiliation, and hopelessness.
Mm.
When these travesties are allowed to manifest themselves, they cause moms to surrender and to succumb to what they say. As we process the challenges of all mothers and their unrelenting love for their children, have we assessed how the world reacts to and treats all sons? What are your thoughts relative to this quote from Miss Cookie Gawain? This is another mom that took one of my surveys. She says, mothers of black sons, We face special challenges. Our sons face, at times, distressing issues, which we as mothers may have to deal with firsthand. She says, I am not a man, nor do I desire to be, but neither am I a weak woman. She goes on to say, I must teach my son how to deal in a world that may misunderstand him. Yes. This world may not see that he is a child, a teen, a man, but instead see him as a threat. It is in shame I teach, not shamed because I teach, but in the fact that I must. She says, so I teach, I implore, sometimes I plead, sometimes I cry. However, as I do so, we will discover and expose with the power of God and our ability the things we need to know. We will root out every adversary, ideology, every trick, every defamation and misinstruction to his manhood, social manipulation, social weapon, and predisposed prejudice. With God, wisdom, we will learn together and will fight every attempt of social bondage. I will teach mental freedom, which comes knowing it is not you, but ignorance, envy, and hate that attempts to impede your unconquerable right, spirit. I will teach my sons freedom of mind and wisdom knowledge. I will teach my sons the truth, not to implant hatred, but wisdom for their survival, because my sons are kings.
Wow.
So as you express that about guilt, excuse me, Cartina, that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
There's no book out there like this.
No.
I wanted moms to understand that stop feeling guilty. Like on the back, let me switch real quickly. I said, and I wrote this for you moms, most mothers do the best that they know how as they are receiving on-the-job training.
Yes.
Rearing their children. Do not allow an alleged lack of parenting skills nor lack of knowledge to derail your best efforts. Ignore the hollow winds of self-labeled experts. Some may openly share their skewed understanding of the parenting processes. Do not allow this to diminish your self-worth, nor your uncompromised, unparalleled love as a mother for your children. Mm. We've all heard, or maybe even stated, that children do not come with a blueprint. This statement may sound cute and comforting. However, imperfection is a part of our human existence.
Yes.
Alexander Pope, 1711, says it best, to err is human, to forgive is divine. So,
wow.
I hope that this book really reaches the masses of mothers, because I wanted to release the mothers from the feeling of guilt.
Yes.
From the feeling of being inadequate, from the feeling of not doing enough. Because right. The world is relentless in its criticism of mothers.
Yes.
But when it comes to assisting them, you can hear the eerie silence.
Exactly. So, Oh, that's so needed. Really does need to reach the masses.
Yes.
Okay, listeners, do you see why I said he's brilliant?
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you for putting in so much work and so much research to really want to know what was on a mother's mind.
Yes.
And then also the research that you put in, knowing what's on our young men's mind, because sometimes we don't know. We live in the same house, and because we expect our men to be men, we don't ask them, are you hurting? Are
yes.
you okay?
Yes.
Do you want to talk? Instead of yes. having that, we're just like, come on, son. You know, we're nurturers, but at the same time, even living in the same house, we don't, you know, there's that line we don't cross. The
right.
guys don't want to show vulnerability. Right. They don't want to show mama that they cry. They want to love for mama.
Right.
And moms, they just want to love them. And it's just a hard balance. And this book really brings this out so
thank you
beautifully and brilliantly.
And thank you.
Please tell us where we can get this. It's so important. Mothers, sons, everyone.
Yes.
If you're not in a parenting relationship, or is so important for anyone.
It is.
Oh, it where is. Where can we find
it? We can get it at www.dyingonmyfeet.com, or you can get it from Barnes and Nobles. Barnes and Nobles is the only store that I have it in right now. It's not on Amazon. Okay. So I would just suggest to your listeners, or anyone that's interested, to contact me via my website. And I always like to give people my telephone number. I tell them I'm not too proud. Hey, call me. I'll be happy. As a matter of fact, I'd be love to talk to them at 440-935-0374. We take most credit cards, and we definitely take cash. So it's $20. It retails for $25, but it's on sale right now for $20. Okay. And we want to get it in as many hands as possible. So if they check www.dyingonmyfeet.com, and they go to publications and scroll down, and they can do a PayPal payment right there. Okay. Or they can contact me via telephone, 440-935-0374. Or they can contact me via email, abrighterfuture91@gmail.com.
Oh, wonderful. Now, can people also reach out to you because you mentor? Do you do speaking engagements?
All the time, yes. I love to speak to parenting groups, schools, even corporate. Yes, I do.
Good.
Yes, if you want to reach out to me, they will still go to that same website, that same email, and that same telephone number. All of those are my business contacts. Mm-hmm. And since I'm pretty much a one-man band, they're going to get me.
Nice. Now tell us your social media. Where can people find you? A lot of people are social media.
We are on Twitter. I need to remember that. But if they type in Melvin Lars,
okay,
they just put in Melvin Lars Twitter. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on I got something I can't even think of. We're on Tumblr. So we're on all the well-known social media groups.
Yes.
If you type in my name in that social media group, it'll pop up.
Wonderful.
And actually, when they go to my website, I have all of my media sites listed.
Very nice.
They can click either one of those, and it'll bring them right to me.
Okay.
Yes. We are LARS. Yes. And for those that may be interested in bringing me in to speak or whatever, I'm very reasonable. I tell them all the time, you know, and I'm very serious about that. I'm very reasonable. And I look forward to it. You know, and I work with people, and I just want to get these books out here and get them in people's hands and share. And that's where we are.
Oh, what a blessing. What a blessing you are. What an inspiration. You know, just listening to, you know, your story and the things that you've gone through, dying on my feet. That touched me, because everything we talked about, from the football journey, the everything you went through during a time where people would have said, nope, you can't do it. We expect you to not make it, you know, past a certain month. And that just shows your resilience. And you know, young people who are listening, who struggle and think, oh, I can't make it. Oh, life is hard. Oh, I got this against me. You know, what a testimony. Beautiful, beautiful testimony. And you're quite an inspiration.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Yes. And I just thank you again. Again, it is just such an honor to know you. Just such an honor. I sincerely mean that. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart.
The honor is mine.
You're a wonderful person. And we're going to continue to stay in touch.
I look forward to it.
You are my support system.
Great.
And you're just wonderful to everyone. You're
thank you.
Yes. You have earned your crown in heaven. You really have.
Thank you. I just appreciate you having me on, because as I told you, I'm a great admirer, I'm a great fan, and I just think you're phenomenal, and you're just one of those stars that continue to shine.
Yes.
And no one's going to be able to put that light out. And I know that you are not going to allow them to put that light out.
Not at all. Not at all. We're going to stand. We've been standing. We're going to stand.
You know, there's an old folks have a saying, when they talk about being the train on the track. I know you've heard that. And they talk about lead, follow, or get out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, hey, the train is moving on the track. Now, you can get on, but if you don't, you're going to get run right over.
That's right.
Get on the train or get off the track.
Yes.
Because we're coming.
There you go.
I didn't say we are coming. I said we're coming. We're coming. So you get off the track and we're coming.
Wonderful, wonderful. Yes. Well, again, everyone, that's Melvin Lars. Make sure you go to his Facebook, go to all his social media, go follow him at his website. That will be provided in links. And please share the book, share the information. You guys, so critical, so important for your young people, so important for us, for our self-esteem. Just a wonderful inspiration. And God bless you, sir. And we
look
forward to better things. I pray for much success and much abundance in your life.
Thank you so very much for having me.
Yes, sir. And we are off. Join us next time. And we thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
You too.